From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hello, and welcome to Korean Context. My name is Jenna Gibson, and I'm your host. This week, we are here with Professor David Steinberg, who currently serves on KEI's board of directors and is a distinguished professor emeritus at Georgetown University. Professor Steinberg was previously a representative of the Asia Foundation in Korea and the president of Mansfield Center for Pacific Affairs. He was also the director for technical assistance in Asia and the Middle East and director for Philippines, Thailand, and Burma affairs for the State Department. He has written extensively on both Myanmar and Korea, including his books Turmoil in Burma, Contested Legitimacies in Myanmar, which was published in 2006, Stone Mirror, Reflections on Contemporary Korea in 2002, and The Republic of Korea, Economic Transformation and Social Change from 1989. Professor Steinberg was educated at Dartmouth College, Lingnan University in Canton, China, Harvard University, and the University of London. So very distinguished guest we have here today, and we're very excited to talk to him about Myanmar and about Korea's relationship with Myanmar. So our listeners know a lot about Korea and Northeast Asia, but some of them might not know that much about Myanmar. And I myself, unfortunately, only know kind of surface level things about Myanmar. For example, that there's been a major opening and that they've recently shifted from a military junta to a more democratic system. But to set the stage, can you give us a little bit more of a summary of what's been happening in Myanmar lately as far as this political transition and them opening up to the international community?
Well, first, as Confucian said, we got to have the rectification of names. Is it Myanmar? Is it Burma? Myanmar is the official name. The United Nations and almost all other countries use it. The United States still insists on Burma because of Aung San Suu Kyi, who is the Nobel laureate, of course, and basically the patron saint of democracies around the world. She has not said use either, but you may remember that it took us from 1949 to about 1977 to call the capital of China Beijing rather than Peking. So we sometimes are behind the curve. There have been remarkable changes in that country, more than any other country in the region. No other country has moved so quickly and so profoundly. What you had essentially since 1962 to 2011 was military rule either directly through a junta or a military-sponsored and controlled political party, a single-party system, the Burma Socialist Program Party. In 1988, there was a sort of coup to back up the previous military regime that had failed. That instituted a junta system. But the military tried to design a system to give them perpetual control over certain aspects of that society that they regarded as essential. This included national unity, national sovereignty, and to keep the civilians out of control of the military. This they accomplished through writing a constitution that was agreed to through a referendum in 2008 that was basically, I would call it Stalinistic in terms of its result, 92-point-something% approval, and then followed by a manipulated election, which everybody regarded as not free and fair, in 2010. In 2011, on March 30th, a new government came in, headed by a former prime minister, a general, who had a very clean record. And his opening speech was remarkable, because it could have been a speech in any democratic country. He said, basically, our country's in real crisis, our educational system has failed, our health system has failed, we have too much corruption, minorities are unhappy, we've got to do something. And it was the first time in over half a century that there was public criticism of the government from the government. Then that began a series of changes. We pushed and they pushed. They wanted better relations with the West, partly, we don't know exactly what percentage, but partly to lessen their dependence on China, partly to get access to the Asian Development Bank and World Bank resources that the United States had denied them. And then to appear in history as a moderating influence, a positive influence on Burmese history. That was very important, I think. These people are patriots, remember, in their own terms. They may be wrong on policies, but they're very strongly nationalistic and patriotic. So what you had was a government that started these reforms. We responded. There was a very careful dance. The administration recognized that it could only go so far. And so it went into change in policy, but the change in policy was quite remarkable, because under the Bush administration, under the Clinton administrations, policy of the U.S. was regime change. Honor the results of a May 1990 election that the opposition won. It was a free and fair election, but the government ignored. And then we'll talk to you, which means get out of power to the military, and then we'll talk to you, which is a non sequitur. The Obama administration changed that. They said basically regime modification. They didn't put it that way, but that's what they meant. And the result was very intense review of policy, the openings of high-level dialogue, which had been denied, and keeping the sanctions because Congress would not agree to get rid of the sanctions. So this was very important because no administration, Democratic or Republican, is going to use a political ammunition on Myanmar. It's not worth it in their view. But what happened, if we look back at this period until November 2015, what we see was it is the only success story, if there are successes in foreign policy, of the Obama administration in East Asia. Have our relations with North Korea improved? And China, Japan, other countries? No, it hasn't. But Myanmar, yes. And because of Myanmar, our relations with ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, improved. But it could not have been improved without improvement of relations with Myanmar first, because we didn't want Myanmar to join ASEAN. So what you have now is lead up to 2015 elections. Those 2015 elections, with the opposition led by Aung San Suu Kyi, won overwhelmingly in what everybody regarded as a free and fair election, with international observers. And the result was that the opposition National League for Democracy basically controls the legislature, but they don't control the government. Aung San Suu Kyi has to play a very delicate role. That role is balancing military interests and, I'd say, more open, pluralistic. But she has demonstrated that she is really not operating as a Democrat. She controls that party absolutely, and nobody can do anything without her approval. And she has demonstrated this by personally appointing the president, all the ministers except three, which are constitutionally controlled by the military, Ministry of Defense, Ministry of Home Affairs, which controls the police, intelligence, and the administration down to the local level, and Border Affairs, which means the minority issues. So they have a very strong say. The question is, how does Aung San Suu Kyi balance this?
Right, so that brings us up to today and into the future. It'll be very interesting to see how things go. But I do want to bring Korea into our conversation here. How has South Korea's relationship been with Myanmar as it goes through some of these changes and transitions? How were their ties before this shift, and how do you characterize relations now?
Well, you have to go back even earlier. Actually, North Korea was part of the non-aligned group, of which Burma was one of the key actors, along with Indonesia and India and China. And the North Koreans in the early days had an embassy, while the South Koreans had a consulate. So the relations, in fact, were closer to North Korea than they were to South Korea. In 1983, President Chun Doo-hwan and his entourage decided to make a trip to Southeast Asia. And Myanmar, Burma in those days, are very important because vast natural resources, a quite large country strategically located, and a country where Japan has important interests. And obviously, Korea is in competition with Japan, even if unstated. He goes and he's to lay a wreath at the memorial to Aung San Suu Kyi's father, the leader of independence who was assassinated in July 1947, just before independence. Three North Korean agents blow up that thing. Missing Chun Doo-hwan, it was late by a minute, but killing 17 Koreans, including most of the cabinet and the critical advisors, I mean, these were really talented people. General Ne Win, who was the dictator at that time, took this as both a personal and national affront. He had personally invited Chun Doo-hwan, and this was a violation of his invitation. So they de-recognized North Korea. And of course, then relations with South Korea began to improve. And the result was that South Korea began to take more of an interest. They started an aid program. It was rather small, but it began to move. At the same time, in the 90s, there was a fear of a US invasion. Now, it's very difficult for the Americans to understand that because we weren't about to invade Myanmar, right? Yet, they feared that. So Korea was looking around, how can we protect ourselves? And the idea of North Korea being, quote, threatened by the United States came into play. So the buying of armaments from North Korea was very important, and Korea was known to have very good artillery, facing Seoul, I might add, but good artillery. Also, there was a rumor, this is unconfirmed, that General Than Shwe, who was a dictator at that time under the juntas from 93 on, he thought that North Korea was standing up to the United States through its nuclear program. This I don't think was true. So he may have wanted to do something, and he sent lots of people to the Soviet Union, then to Russia, for training in some aspects of nuclear stuff. There's never any evidence that the Burmese had a nuclear program, but there are lots of rumors. But the United States was concerned that North Korea was violating UN sanctions by selling, giving away armaments, technology to the Burmese. In 2008, the commander-in-chief of the army made a surreptitious trip to North Korea, which was later leaked. And he then saw many of the military installations. At the end of the Sunshine Policy in Korea, you have to understand two things. One is that President Kim Dae-jung had a thing about Burma, about Myanmar. He talked to me many, many times before he was president, in the Blue House, in his home after he became retired from the presidency. He said, I want to go to Burma and release Aung San Suu Kyi from house arrest, and then democracy will come to Asia. In any case, he really believed that. When Nguyen became president, as one of his last acts, his ambassador in Rangoon told the Burmese foreign minister that if Myanmar wanted to re-recognize North Korea, South Korea would not object. So rather than isolate North Korea at that point, Korea was trying to open them up. And Burma seemed one small element of that opening. Where the United States comes into this is that we have told the Burmese very clearly that in order to completely improve relations with them, you must sever inappropriate ties with North Korea, not diplomatic recognition, but armament sales. You must adhere to the embargoes that are in place, the sanctions that are in place in North Korea. According to the State Department, they have been on track to do that. That doesn't mean they've completed it.
So to pick up from there, it seems like there's kind of almost a tug of war that as relations with South Korea get slightly better, relations with North Korea get worse and vice versa. And I was reading a piece that you had written last fall called Myanmar Turns Its Back on North Korea. So bringing up until today, can you give us a little more background on this chill in relations, and do you see it continuing to be low, or do you see it coming back toward North Korea in the coming years?
No, South Korea has a major contribution to Myanmar's development and a major commitment, which North Korea does not have. Years ago, I met with the president of Daewoo, which at that time had textile factories, and he commented on how good these factories were, how well they were operating. Later, Daewoo was the company that found and negotiated offshore gas worth whatever billions of dollars it may be, which eventually most of it was sold to China. And China constructed a gas pipeline from the Bay of Bengal to Kunming in Yunnan province to transport this and to convert and to sell inside China as part of the Chinese policy for energy autonomy, if you will. So Daewoo was involved with that. The investments from Myanmar have now got into very important elements. For example, the Myanmar Economic Institute is really the Korean Development Institute that was founded under Park Chung-hee and became a model in much of Asia, including in Thailand. TDRI, Thailand Development Research Institute, was modeled on KDI. And this Myanmar Development Institute, in which the Korean government is putting in $20 million, which will, in fact, do economic planning for the government, becomes a critical element. They also have all kinds of foreign aid projects, including Seymaul, the New Village Movement, which is rural development, which in my view, I have some skepticism about this. Not that I have seen the one in Myanmar, I have not, but I have seen them in Korea. And while they work in Korea, they may not work in other less military organized countries. In other words, it requires a kind of vigor of administration that Park Chung-hee could bring to South Korea. But for example, the Philippine Minister of Planning told me would not happen in the Philippines. So yes, South Korea now is on the ascendancy.
I'm glad you mentioned the aid program, because that's something that South Korea is really known for, and you know, known for having become a donor country after receiving aid. But there are also a lot of these business deals, some of which you also mentioned, but there's a major highway project that was recently announced, and there was a memorandum of understanding between a Korean bank and a Burmese bank.
It's a wide variety of things.
Right. So that's, I was going to ask you, is this a few one-off things, or is this really a sign of deepening economic ties between these two countries?
It's deepening economic ties and a deepening impression in Seoul. I had dinner with somebody in the economic section of the Korean embassy here in Washington. And the person said, well, I'm leaving Washington. I've been here 3 years. I'll be assigned someplace. It won't be a very good assignment because Washington is, you know, one of the best assignments you can get, right? And so I said, what about Myanmar? I said, oh no, Myanmar is a very desirable assignment for the foreign ministry people because there's action, because things are happening, and Korea is on the upswing. So it's recognized not only at the national level, but it's recognized within the Foreign Service of Korea.
Right, so you see this really as just a starting point.
As a starting point, if South Koreans think that they will overwhelm the Japanese, I would say no, that will not happen. The Japanese have too much invested in there, too many factories and so forth. The Dilawa industrial project zone, industrial zone outside of Rangoon, terribly important. The Tavoy Dawei one on the Tenasserim coast near Thailand is another one. The Chinese have a very important one at Jeonpyo, which is the terminus of their oil and gas pipelines that go to Kunming. And the Chinese have a lot of other hydroelectric investments. Korea is very popular. I don't believe that the Korean wave is a necessarily important part of foreign policy. But I can tell you that I know colonels in the Burma army who say their favorite television station is Arirang. And they like the soap operas and they like everything else. So there is an element there where Korea is on the ascendancy. And the fact that President Park Geun-hye said, is supposed to have said, North Korea should copy South Korea economically and Myanmar politically. That was not a very well thought through statement, unfortunately. The reforms in Myanmar have been very important, but the conditions are different. Myanmar has at least one third of the population composed of different ethnic groups. How many you can disagree with, but at the same time, I mean, North Korea is basically a homogenous society, and socially that means a lot. However, there are lessons to be learned from Myanmar, obviously, and one hopes that both South Korea and North Korea would learn from those lessons. But imitating that country is not going to work.
Right, so we've got a lot of information here, a lot of hopefully new and interesting information for our listeners about Myanmar. But before we wrap up, I just want to ask you, do you have any advice from the Burmese side? How would you advise them to get the most bang for the buck, if you will, from their relationship with Korea?
Korea has several things going that I should mention. I was told there may be 5,000 Koreans in Myanmar, but there are many, many illegal missionaries, Christian missionaries, which could provide problems, as they have in some other countries, because foreign missionary activity is illegal. Local Christian stuff is not, but that should be something to keep in the background. The other thing, the most important thing generally, is this. I would argue that Myanmar is composed of a series of societies that view themselves as vulnerable. They view themselves as vulnerable for different reasons, that they have been colonized, because Korea has felt vulnerable to Japan, and to a degree, vulnerable culturally to China. But the Burmans, the majority group, feel this vulnerability. Minority groups feel vulnerable towards each other and towards the majority Burmans. And they feel not only vulnerable politically and economically, they feel vulnerable culturally. So what should Korea do? Korea should be very, very careful that this vulnerability is not exploited to a degree where it causes resentment. To give you an example from another country, one province of South Korea wanted to establish a Korean cultural center and golf course in a UNESCO protected cultural site in another country, completely inappropriately. And when the ambassador of that country complained to me about this, it was never allowed. But the idea that you would do this is a problem. So the sensitivity towards this is important, because we've seen it now happen, that under the authoritarian junta, you've got a lot of anti-colonial propaganda. But then as after that, when the press began to open up, you got a bunch in the press and in literature, anti-Chinese feeling. And now we are on the wave of an anti-Muslim feeling in that society. And what is going to happen next is an anti-Western or modern influence. 2 days ago, the Monks Association, two right-wing Monks Associations, complained that at one of the major hotels in downtown Yangon, the porters and the bellboys were dressed in costumes from the Pagan dynasty of the royalty. Now, what those costumes really were, nobody knows. But this was, in other words, this was an affront, a secular affront. It wasn't a religious affront. So that movement from the religious to the secular sensitivity is important. It's going to expand. As pop culture comes in, as Korean pop culture comes in, as Koreans do not pay attention to social norms, the Burmese will not take that. And so the Korean government, while it can't control what the people do on tours, has got to be able to warn them that it's in the Korean national interest to keep control over inappropriate behavior. And so for relations to continue to improve, this cultural sensitivity has to be taken into account.
Okay, so I would say that's a really great way to end our discussion today after a really deep and fascinating look at Myanmar and Korea's relationship with Myanmar. So thank you very much for being here and for being our guest.
Pleasure to be here.
That's all for this episode of Korean Context. As always, thank you so much for joining us for this great conversation. Please remember to subscribe on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts. And do remember that you can go back and listen to our archive of episodes at keia.podbean.com. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll be back again next week with another great episode.